Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Shepard.
And I'm Chad Shepard.
And coming up on Shep Shower and Shave, today we talk to all-pro former Lions wide receiver Herman Moore. We talk about the Lions draft. We talk about how he stays in such great shape and some of the great memories that he had with some of the best Lions teams that we can recall. That's all coming up here on Shep Shower and Shave. Shep Shower and Shave is brought to you by Fifth Avenue in Royal Oak. That's where we're broadcasting right now. What a fantastic venue this is for all the great beer specials in Gone Country, which is a bar crawl that starts on Saturday, June 24th. This is where you want to start it, right here. Tony, Dan, and the rest of the crew here at Fifth Avenue in Royal Oak. And we're brought to you by Northwestern Tech. Herman Moore is a good friend of mine, and Herman Moore is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, wide receiver in Lions history. And he joins us here on Shep Shower and Shave. How do you stay in such great shape, man? I mean, you know, here's what I've always noticed with guys who play football. The big guys, when they're done, they end up losing weight. The smaller guys end up gaining weight. You are pretty close to your playing weight and size. Is that fair?
I'm spot on right now at 218 pounds. This is probably when I was at my optimal weight, and when I was, you know, repeatedly going to the Pro Bowl, played at 218 pounds. You try and eat lean and get a little bit of exercise in, and as you get older, as you know, I mean, you got to be able to take care of yourself, and so your body takes care of yourself. You talked about how these guys, when they the little fellas like to get to become really big fellas. I've seen some of the defensive backs that have, they're like 300 pounds. And I'm not, hey, listen, I'm being honest. 300 pounds from 185, 200 pounds, they're 300 pounds now.
How does that happen?
Is it just so much work to maintain when they're younger and they are smaller that when they let it go, it's kind of like a bursting belt and they just really let it go?
I think what happens is the guys that did all the running, now think about this. We do all the running. Mm-hmm. Defensive backs, wide receivers, there's a ton of running. They probably get tired of running, so they don't want to do it anymore. The linemen, they don't have to go far. They're in shorter spaces, short bursts, and then now when they get older, it's like, oh, I'm going to go out and run, and then all of a sudden they start getting into it, and the weight starts falling off, and all of a sudden they're smaller than I am.
Well, but you were a track star, too, and your wife was a track star, too, at the University of Virginia. So do you think that helps? I mean, do you enjoy running? Is it something you still enjoy doing?
I just enjoy staying active. Physically fit, and it also saves you money. You don't have to keep changing your wardrobe all the time and changing out clothes. You know how that gets.
Yeah.
You start complaining at the dry cleaners that your clothes are shrinking because you're gaining weight, and you want to be, you know, upset with everybody else. I don't want to do that. I just enjoy, and I go around. I talk a lot to communities, talk a lot to the kids and the education systems about the importance of health and nutrition.
Is that a big difference to you now, the level of access to that kind of information people have? Not only players in the NFL, but just your everyday person at home. They knew things that you guys were learning from specialized nutritionists back when you were playing days.
You learn a lot, and there is the ability to be able to have access to a lot of information, even on how to lose weight, how to eat healthy, foods that aren't good for you. And that's all good stuff. And right now, if you want to have longevity and live a healthy life, you have to care enough to be concerned about what you put in your body, and that's what I try and preach.
Lions used a third-round draft pick on a kid by the name of Kenny Golladay out of Northern Illinois. You called some Mid-American Conference games with me when we were partnered together as voices of Eastern Michigan football, and I remember a couple of conversations you and I had where you're like, man, I'm kind of surprised at the level of play of certain players in the Mid-American Conference. You coming from the ACC, people don't always get an opportunity to see mid-majors. What's the most important characteristic a wide receiver should have as he makes the transition from college to pro, do you think?
You have to first and foremost recognize that you're starting over. The level of competition evens out. I would imagine the kids that come from those conferences that aren't called the SEC and all these major conferences, they have the ability to come in, and I think at a different mindset, because they're always still hungry. They're trying to prove their worth. They're trying to prove that they can play at that higher level. The thing that I see most is that they don't realize the speed of it, and that's been, even from my time and even before I came into the NFL, the speed and the athleticism of the game continues to get better and better. Now, where you can win is through consistency and technique. That's the thing that I see that has fallen off. The kids don't come in as sharp. They don't come in as disciplined on the fundamentals of football or the technical aspects of the game. So if there's a place where you can separate yourself from the pack, it comes off of the ability to be more detailed and a little bit better at sharpening your tools.
He was a three-time Pro Bowler, and he is still Virginia's all-time single-season receiving leader. Herman Moore is with us on Shep, Shower, and Shave. Who taught you? I mean, maybe at Virginia and then when you made it to the next level.
There was a guy, Tom Sherman. He used to be a quarterback for Penn State, and when I came in, he was not only the guy that recruited me when I was out of Danville, Virginia, George Washington High School, but he was also the guy that coached the wide receivers, and he was very much a stickler about technique. It wasn't so much about you got to go out and learn everything at once, but we had to do it in phases to where you perfected every aspect of the game. And that's why it was known as being a hands catcher, because he wouldn't allow us to cradle the ball. He wouldn't allow us to catch it in our body.
Yeah.
And then working footwork and then understanding how to catch passes that weren't perfect passes. That's why I never complain about a bad pass, because I don't think there really is one if you can get your hands near it. If you create those type of fundamentals and you start to eliminate the reason for excuses, you make players better. When you talk about Galladay, and I had an opportunity to meet him at a rookie symposium, a rookie get-together that we had with the alumni base here in Detroit. Big kid, has a lot of athleticism, has the ability. And I asked him, I said, what have you seen to be the most challenging thing so far coming in? He said, learning the playbook and just how the speed of things. And you can't play at that top speed because you're learning. And when you're thinking and you're trying to do it at the same time, it slows you down. But I told him, I said, just take it in one little bit at a time. And then as you continue to get better, the game will become slower, but you will play faster.
You mentioned a key word there, and that's thinking. That'll slow you down a lot. Because so much is new to him, a lot of it's just a matter of reps, isn't it? He's got to do some of these things for the second, third, fourth time, as opposed to everything he's doing being brand new. Then it becomes a little more second nature, and over time you develop that skill set to a point where all of a sudden you're a veteran walking into your ninth or tenth camp and you're teaching the younger guys.
You're absolutely right, and he has the opportunity now. That third slot is really wide open, and right now I almost say it's his to lose. When I look at his size and his ability, he can provide them that piece where you need a guy that can create. And it's not that Marvin Jones can't do that. He's a certain type of receiver. Golden Tate is a certain type of receiver that has a specialty. But they don't have that guy that goes out and creates. And he can come up with plays when plays aren't there. But he has the physical ability to do that. And like you're saying, I mean, if he goes out and understands that the game is fast and I can get away from having to think about it, the playbook will start to look very easy. It actually becomes his friend. And not something that's working against him.
Derek Carr today for the Oakland Raiders signed an extension that will make him the highest paid player in the NFL. Should the Lions lock up Matt Stafford and give him that title, do you believe?
No, they should lock me up and let me play quarterback instead for 12. I look at it this
way. I don't think
way.
You'd be doing podcasts if that were the case.
No. But listen, with Matthew Stafford, the question becomes, is he worth that money? He is worth that money because he's worth that to the Detroit Lions. Can he get that somewhere else, depending on the depth, depending on the team's need, depending on their defense, depending on their offensive line? Some teams can get away with not having to pay a guy $25 million to produce the stats that you would get from a guy like Matthew Stafford. But the Lions are in a position to where this team's success, God forbid that Matthew Stafford, anything happens, puts this team at a tough position. Look at when you lose your left tackle.
Right.
What disarray it puts your
Taylor
offense
Decker,
into.
Yeah.
Now lose your quarterback.
Yeah.
Now which one? Now what does that do? So $25 million probably looks like a pretty good deal for the Lions for Matthew Stafford.
Because you played at such a high level, because you were so great, do you watch football games and say, I would have liked to have played with that guy, I would have liked to have caught passes from that guy, or is that too much of a fandom on my part? Would you have liked to have caught passes from a guy like Matt Stafford?
You know what? People ask me that all the time. I'm not going to sit there and throw a guy like Scott Mitchell under the bus or a guy like Eric Kramer. The only thing I would have asked for, and I think any receiver looks for, is consistency at the position.
Okay.
Just like a quarterback looks for a consistency and rapport with his receivers at a position. You don't want to constantly have guys coming in and coming out. And we had that too much of that rotation that was taking place with the quarterback position. We had too much uncertainty, even when we picked a guy like Scott Mitchell, that there became some inconsistency, there became some concern. Those are the things that hurt you as a team. You have to be able to work through sometimes when things aren't quite right to figure out what's the right formula and the right mix. And I don't think that we paid enough attention until you saw Matthew Stafford really settle in and become that guy, this is the first time in 20 years that it's kind of settled down.
There's no questions about the position.
Right. Or less than 20 years. I don't know how old I am. But it's been a minute before we had a guy before Matthew that you could just sit there and not worry about what the quarterbacking situation looked like.
Had you ever wanted to get involved in front office? I mean, you're a good evaluator of talent, and I know that because you and I talk a lot of football during the season. You tell me who you like. When you and I called college football together, you made certain notes about certain guys. Did you ever want to get into a front office?
I would have loved to had the ability to be in a coaching or a front office position because I love analyzing. I love analytics. I love predictive modeling. I love taking and looking physically at someone and being able to determine what their capabilities are. When you understand the game, you understand what the elements are that are needed. You can spread that around every position because there's some consistency in mindset. There's some consistency in athletic ability that is needed if you understand what the position requires. There's an understanding of character and what that means. There's some intangibles that we don't think are relevant when it comes to making the whole player and making the team gel together. And when you can put that all together and create that recipe, that's the stuff. I like challenges of being able to figure out how do you fix this? Right, how do you fix things?
It's too easy when on paper everything just adds up.
All right,
one is two. There's got to be some – it's almost a black box factor where you know the input, you know the output. What's going on in the middle there? And a guy who can recognize that and figure that out has a place in an NFL front office.
And the other thing to that, you have to be able to be willing to step outside of it and just not say, I'm comfortable looking at film. You can't just watch film all day. And determine that you have the right players and you have the right team.
Right, you do a good job of that.
You got to analyze everything as a whole and play some of the odds too. But the game has evolved. The sport has changed. There's a lot more tools and ways to evaluate. Even when you look at the combines, it's more than just, you know, you see that starting to evolve a little bit more because we realize it's more than just a 40-yard dash that determines whether or not a guy can, in the skill position, can play.
Never been a big fan of that. What's your take on Bob Quinn so far, or is it too early in his tenure?
I believe it's still too early in his tenure. I look at it like this. Michigan is a big market for real estate. You go out and you find property and you figure out how to rehab it. I look at Quinn as being similar. He said, okay, I've acquired this property. I've acquired this opportunity. Now I got to go in and fix some things. There are some things that are very visible. If I got a broken window, I know I need to replace it. If I got some things over the door, I got to put a new door in. Security systems, lawn, all these things that make it right. But then all of a sudden I get into the infrastructure and I start looking behind the walls and you start realizing, oh man, these things start to break down, things go wrong. You're constantly in this stage of having to repair and fix. I don't know where it's going to lead to him, but now I'm going to determine on his skill set, is he capable of fixing things when they break? Mm-hmm. That's how I'm evaluating Bob Quinn.
The left tackle situation.
Now, what do you do to offset that? You can't always go out and get the player that you need, but how do I make things around that better? Mm-hmm. How do I work with my coaching staff to make sure that that doesn't become problematic now that we know it's a known thing? And that's what we work and we focus on. We don't focus on the fact that we've lost a guy, we're not going to have him, and that's going to be the end of our season.
I think a lot of Lions fans, when Taylor Decker went down, obviously it's a huge disappointment, but seeing the speed with which Bob Quinn reacted and that his plan, his contingency plan, was a little different than what we might have seen in the past was a positive thing to them. Because I think in years past, a lot of Lions fans think that, okay, that gap gets filled internally with a guy who maybe just isn't cut out for that job. And instead, Bob Quinn has no problem coming out and sending a six-round pick to St. Louis. And I know Greg Robinson isn't going to be handed the job or may not even ever play for the Lions in a high-leverage capacity. But the fact that he moved with conviction to go get that guy and then signed Cyrus Kwanjo and took Joe Dahl out of a situation that may have put him in dire straits, I think that made a lot of Lions fans feel really impressed with the way he covered for Taylor Decker.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Do you think you know how everyone looks at the Patriots and the domination of the Patriots. Are you a franchise legacy team type of guy? Do you think it's good for the league, or do you think it's really important the league have a little bit more balance there and other champions than the Patriots dominating the way they have?
I love legacies, and I like teams that dominate because that's what makes it special. When you look at And I'll switch over. I'll jump sports on you for a minute. When you watch Golden State, how many of us really paid a lot of attention to the NBA? I don't want to make anyone mad, but you start waiting for the playoffs. You start waiting for certain matchups to take place. But when you can find teams that start to create that aura, that start to create that just dynasty, and they sit on a pedestal that seems higher than others, you like seeing teams shoot for something and some entity they got to knock off. When you, it also makes it, you get those premium tickets. You don't want to see two sub-500 teams just kind of just fighting all the time and battling all the time. You want to see the ones where it's like, this is going to be one of those games that's a must-see type TV thing. I enjoy it. It gives you something to kind of wrap something around.
I agree with you, and I'll add this on. I think the Patriots, being how good they are, raises the level of play of the rest of the league. It says, here's how good you have to be. And like you compared with Golden State, Golden State came out, took care of business, and won a title this year in the NBA. And now the talk of the NBA offseason is, how is Cleveland going to respond? How are they going to counter their roster?
Or anybody going
to
respond?
Yeah, people perceive Cleveland to be the closest in line, but how are they going to make tweaks on their end so that they can get back to Golden State, acknowledging that there is a standard, there's a bar there that has to be met by the rest of the league. And I think it's good to have a really high standard.
Speaking of basketball, is Virginia a basketball school?
It has taken over.
I mean, Tony Bennett's done a good job there. They don't play exciting brand of college basketball, but
defense.
They win, man.
But and that doesn't stop him from being in the conversation every time there's a major head coaching
vacancy. That's true. That's true, because he wins.
Because what he did is he said, okay, we may not be able to sit here and score, but if we can keep the scoring down and play excellent defense and transition defense and offense, we could be a pretty good team, and we don't have a lot of turnovers. They're a disciplined basketball team.
Yeah. And they don't foul a whole lot.
They won't beat themselves. And they got to do that in the ACC against teams like Duke and North Carolina, who they're facing twice a year.
Why do we do this, though? Why do we use phrases like defense wins championships, and then when a team plays defense like that, all we do is chop them down?
Because the excitement of scoring is fun. No one wants to see a football game with a lot of field goals.
Right. You're right. I mean, when Alabama and LSU played and it was 9-6 in the championship game, people thought it was one of the worst, but it was a great defensive battle. You have to have a certain perspective, do you not?
I like to say this, though. You know, in basketball, I really don't like seeing a lot of defense now, because I've gotten so used to the 40 points in the first quarter.
Right.
That's just phenomenal. That's a lot of shooting, and you're waiting to see guys launch long. You know, the dunk has become kind of old, unless you're dunking over somebody and it's spectacular.
Right.
And guys are so tall and
athletic.
You're
posterizing somebody.
Yeah.
Cool.
Right. It's different. Football is exciting when you have a lot of scoring, but defense, when you got that defense that shuts down teams, I don't know. It's just something about it for me. I think it's pretty cool.
I think it's harder for the average fan to appreciate good basketball defense as well, because normally you're the guy in the YMCA squatting low, and you know, you really can't tell effective defense because the game's not well officiated in that case. It's probably going to be a foul when you think you made a nice play, things like that. I think there's just less appreciation for the average fan for a tough defensive basketball team.
The only thing that's become bad for me when I look at basketball is every time a guy shoots and he misses, he looks at, I don't care, he might look at a fan in the stands thinking the fan fouled him.
Hold on a second. Wide receivers do the same thing.
No, man.
On every route, wide receivers do the same thing.
No, come on, Matt. I can't let you throw the wide receivers under the bus, man. Nowadays, I can agree. I don't know why anyone complains.
Not back in your day.
Yeah, I mean, you were getting mauled and held and that 5-yard rule, you know, anything went within the first 5 yards. I mean, grabbing and just.
Was it better then? Do they need to return to that?
Yeah, it would be a little bit more exciting.
Not to mention you're wearing.
And also make the middle become that danger zone again.
Yeah.
Right. They're not going to do that ever. But
you were also wearing shoulder pads that today's linebackers are wearing and things like that.
Well, same thing with the helmets. Herman will be the first to tell you. I mean,
even the face mask.
Herman's as sharp as it gets, but you went through it. You had a lot of concussions,
didn't
you?
Yeah, six.
I think it was
six. Yeah, six that I know
that
of.
That you know of.
I'm going to go back through and look at my records, because I have about 1,500 pages of every medical record that was given to me.
Wow. Okay.
And even handwritten notes.
All right, now this is a tough question here. You heard what Warren Sapp said recently, right? Okay? He's donating his brain to science because he's forgotten some things. Have you reached the point where you've forgotten some things that raises your level of concern?
Absolutely. Short term is bad. You know, giving yourself text or having people text you messages on a regular basis or remind you of things, because you for me it's forgetting a lot of things short term. Long term, it's hard to really go back and remember a ton of things. I'm not just saying that because it's like whatever, but it It is. It's even childhood things. It's just memories. Things are just gone. And I know you lose a little bit when you get older.
Yeah.
But it is. There are some concerns. I have some concerns when it comes to that.
Does your body ache the way Calvin Johnson described his body aching after he started getting up in the morning?
It does. It takes a little bit, probably a half an hour or so, just to kind of get going, because everything seems really stiff, and your motion and your movements are a little different. And I've separated all fingers. I've separated my both shoulders. I've had knee injuries, foot injuries. You know, you name it. And when you have an accumulation of all those injuries, at some point, it catches up with you. And I try and keep it and offset it a little bit with trying to stay physically active, but it becomes challenging.
What was it like playing for George Welsh at Virginia? He's the all-time leader in Cavaliers football history as a head coach and seemed like a great guy. What made those years special for you when you were contending for ACC titles?
With George Welsh, he was a stickler for discipline, and he really wanted us to be a very disciplined, detail-oriented football team. He really, because of his Navy background, he really wanted us to go out and make sure that we were men and that we were in control at all times of everything that we did out on the field, that we didn't allow our emotions to overtake us. And all those things. I'll tell you real quick a quick story I had with George. There was a guy that I just really didn't think liked me. Even though they brought me and gave me a scholarship and all those things, I realized later he really wanted to just get the most out of me. But I remember it was a defining moment that turned it around for me there. Sean Moore had thrown a football pass to me. It was kind of low on the ground. It skipped one time before it got to me, and I kind of left the football land on the ground, and I walked away from it. And I was walking back to the huddle versus jogging back, and he said, very peacefully, "Herman, run back to the huddle." And I just kind of looked at him and didn't say anything, and then he yelled it at me, and then it caused me to kind of get outside of myself and be a little bit more vocal back to him. And then he just said, "You're out of here. Get off my field." And he says, "And take, you know, and when you get in there, take off my uniform, take off our uniform. You're no longer on this team." And I literally started taking off everything, walking back.
Really, just leaving it there.
You left the trail.
There's a shoe, there's a sock, here's your helmet, here's your shoulder pad, here's everything. Realizing I was going to run out of clothes pretty quick if I either didn't hurry up and get into the locker room or come to my senses. But I realized how immature that was, and at the end of the day, I was hurting nothing but myself. And he came back and told me to come back to the team because he felt that I hadn't completed my destiny. And from that day,
what year was that?
That was my junior year, going into my junior year.
Really?
Before we started that season, which I ended up becoming a starter.
Set the single season record, I believe, in receiving yards.
Just became a tremendous year for me, and ended up being an All-American, and leading the nation in some categories, and finishing in the Heisman Trophy. And I could have thrown that all away over something stupid. And that was, he was just asking me to check my character by saying, "Hey, run back to the huddle."
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a great story. Do you think, or do you have any empathy for the younger guys who, I mean, in today's day and age, maybe that moment never gets to occur because it's open practice and there's fans and media there and your coach acts differently and the player responds differently? Do you think some of those teaching moments are lost for these younger guys because of technology and the media landscape and social media constantly broadcasting everything?
It is. You have to be able to let these guys not only grow up, but you have to. There's got to be accountability. We talk about accountability on the field, but the accountability off the field a lot of times is what prevents these guys from really reaching that apex and reaching that top goal in their career. We have to also be willing to allow them some space and understanding that times do and have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as the older generation, whether it's coaches, parents, whatever, we have to be able to also understand some of the challenges that they may have, and also how do we adjust and how do we adapt so that we can intelligently provide them information that is useful versus criticizing. That it comes across sometimes and restricting their space. So there's some education that needs to take place on both sides, and as long as that occurs, I think we become assets to these younger players, and we help secure their future wherever that destiny may lead them.
All right, before I let you go, because I know you got another appointment, why do you still live here? You could live anywhere you want, okay? But you had a nice long career here in Detroit, and you and your wife have chose to keep this home. What is it about Metro Detroit, about the state of Michigan, that allowed you to really keep your roots here now, or replant your roots, if you will?
Came here in Michigan in 91 when I was 20 years old,
right. And
soon to be 21, and I grew up here. I mean, that's the bottom line. I was born and raised in Virginia, but I grew up in Michigan. And this is what I've gotten to know. The people here is where I've established who I am today, and the personality and certain characteristics that make me who I am. So I've adopted a lot of... there's a lot that within me that is Michigan. And when I go back to Virginia, it's funny because it seems slower, but it's a beautiful state.
Oh, I love
so
Virginia.
I got that dual piece going, but at the same time, I've loved the response of the community, and then also being here, the way I've been received has been phenomenal, and that's why I look to stay.
I'll tell you, one of the coolest things, Chad, that I experienced was I went back to Virginia when Eastern Michigan was playing, and I forget which team it was now, but we went to the Virginia Hall of Fame, and we walked through it, and I remember I sent you a text or I called you. You know, obviously Herman was right in there, and hit the Virginia Hall of Fame is right down the street from Sweet Georgia Browns, right? The former Lion, Roger Brown, owns a restaurant there.
Okay.
Now it's not as spacious as Fifth Avenue. I don't think they're, you know, it's not as enjoyable on the outside, but it's right down the street from the Virginia Hall of Fame, and we had a chance to go in there and see Herman Moore's bust in there. It was really, really cool.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah.
That was an honor to be recognized there, and also being recognized here at the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame.
Right, right.
And
that's a hell of an impact, don't you think?
It goes a long way.
Yeah.
And the irony, when I got inducted into the Virginia Sports Hall of Fame, it was Bobby Ross who sat on the board who made the recommendation. And here's a guy that he and I were like oil and water at times when he was here, and had an opportunity to mend the fences with him, because I don't like to hold grudges, and I don't want anyone holding grudges against me. And it was a special moment. I went in with Alonzo Mourning and a couple other really, you know, notable Virginians. And
and then who'd you go into the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame with?
Now you test me. That's that short-term memory piece there, right there. Long-term piece.
Just real quick, the Bobby Ross situation.
That's a good question. I'm going to have to go look that up.
Why was that important for you to mend that fence with Bobby?
Because of the way everything went when he was here. They came in with a different mindset. You saw it happen with whether it's Robert Porche, Barry, myself, and they had an idea how they wanted to shape the team. And along that meant reshaping us as players, refocusing our thoughts and our contributions to the team, which we may not agree with. And when you worked a long time together with players and systems to determine who you are, and all of a sudden that gets upended, and now you have to become something that you don't feel that you are. And for me, it was more of a different type of wide receiver that I don't think really allowed me to flourish and become the guy that I was. And it was indicative in my contribution to the team.
Gotcha.
And the last 4 or 5 years I had here, I mean, I don't think I even got, 1,000 yards. And it was just a sharp fall off. And you feel that somebody's got to be responsible for that other than yourself. And I think I had to carry some of the blame when I look back as an older individual. In hindsight, I could have made a different decision. I could have approached it a little bit differently. I think that would have helped the relationship. But I felt that the coach could have done the same, and I still say that to this day.
Yeah,
it takes two to tango in that in the arena of communication.
Yep. Chad just brought it up. 2010. There's your class.
Oh, there it is. Marion Ilitch. Yep.
Marion Ilitch, George Braha, Bill Fleming,
and Eddie Murray's going to be mad at me because he's a guy, and I didn't even remember that. Yep. And Peter Carmano.
Rick Leach, Meg Mallon, hell of a golfer. Okay. Peter Carmano,
John Urbanchek,
yeah,
and George Blah, man, I know he's the one to probably slap me too.
Yeah, That's a hell of a class right there.
And it's an all-time great class for sure.
Yeah.
And great guys. And like I said, man, it's you meet so many people, and I always apologize. I hope I never receive one of those really big awards. I'm going to just thank everybody and not try and break it down to individuals, because I know I'm going to leave out somebody important, because there are so many people, whether you're a professional athlete or whether you're a business person or a school teacher, it doesn't matter. There are people who impact your life that give you that defining moment, that turning point, that gives you that advice that makes the difference.
Yeah.
And you just never want to leave anybody out. And I can't get to being who I am without help.
Well, it's great stuff, man. I appreciate your friendship very much.
Likewise.
I enjoy spending time with you. I love talking not just football, but I learned so many different things about life when you and I have good, long discussions like this. So thanks a lot for joining us on Chef Shower and Shape. We'll talk soon, I hope, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you guys both.
All right, you got it. That's Herman Moore, one of the all-time greats in Detroit Lions history, three-time Pro Bowler. And when you look at his numbers, 670 receptions, over 9,100 yards, over 60 touchdowns. Very, very impressive. Joining us here at Fifth Avenue, which has been a premier destination in Royal Oak, with over 36 cold beers on tap, great food, drink specials, a kitchen that is open until 2 a.m. Just met some of the guys back in the kitchen. They are fantastic. They've got some of these great appetizers out here. You want to take advantage of it. It's right here, Fifth Avenue. We're out here on the outdoor amazing patio that takes place. Inside, they've got billiards. This entire staff, not only really, really attractive women, but people devoted to making your experience a memorable one. Stop by and make sure you come on by and take advantage of it. 40 HD TVs, a 14-foot HD projection screen as well. And coming up on Saturday, don't forget the bar crawl that should begin right here at Fifth Avenue. You can check in at 12 o'clock. It's a 1 to 6 p.m. It's got a ton of bars throughout the Royal Oak area, but this is where you either want to start or end up. Fifth Avenue right here in Royal Oak.
Yeah, I just came from work. I can't imagine a better destination to leave the office and head right to. It's outside. It's a little warm today, and it's still absolutely beautiful on the porch.
Sometimes it's better when it's warm because and then you get a lot of young ladies dressed to the climate, and that's exactly what young men like you don't mind whatsoever. Let's shift gears here for a moment and remind people that not just is Fifth Avenue a proud sponsor of Chef Shower and Safe Show, so is Northwestern Tech. Heating and cooling employers are desperate for trained technicians. They're having to turn work down because they don't have the people to meet the demand. So they are the number one player in the HVAC field and are seeing their pay potential go way up. They're able to choose companies that's going on to help them grow their careers. You go to Northwestern Tech. That's where you go. Over the last 38 years, people have been getting jobs left and right because of Northwestern Tech's and their ability to turn out high-qualified people. And Northwestern Tech is the HVAC school. Get trained, certified, and into the field in only 10 and a half months. It's the HVAC school that works. 248-358-4006. Great stuff with Herman Moore. Really appreciate that. I wanted your thoughts on what took place on Wednesday night in Las Vegas. Golden Knights, with the expansion draft, decided to go out, and I think they loaded up on 13 defensemen, Chad. 13 defensemen. But I said this during the week. I tweeted this, and I talked about it a lot. I thought you and I both agreed. The one person that I wanted, or the one person I disagreed with in protecting or not protecting, as far as Ken Holland was concerned, was Thomas Noshek. Thomas Noshek, 23 years old, 6'3", 210-pound winger, a guy who I thought would make a really good third or fourth line guy, and I thought they should have left Gustav Nyquist unprotected. I always want to say the London Knights.
I even have trouble dropping the loss, and they're just the Vegas Golden Knights. And I even in our last episode, I think I called them the Las Vegas Golden Knights repeatedly.
I just did.
It's just Vegas.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the Vegas Golden Knights take Thomas Noshek from the Red Wings. What was your thought on that, and how disappointed are you, if at all?
Look, it stinks. There's no two ways about it. But considering, I think, what could have been lost, it's not the biggest loss in the world. Look, in a situation like this, you look at it and you say, okay, assume we were going to lose that player anyways, what could we have gotten for them? And I don't think the value coming back for Thomas Noshek is all that high. I don't think he's a top six center. So if he's a bottom six center, and we acknowledge in our episode earlier this week that the one of the most bizarre things about the Ken Holland situation that people are so angry about is the bad contracts. And the bad contracts are anchor down the middle. You've locked in Sheahan for however many years, Glendening for however many years, Helm for however many years, Nielsen, and right. then either Larkin or Zetterberg, depending on what your line combinations are. I think that's frustrating to a lot of fans. Thomas Noshek might have come in and been a great penalty kill guy or power play guy or to help in that bottom six, but I'm not so beaten up over it because I don't think we lost the perceived value of what we could have gotten for him in some kind of trade. I think, and I thought the question was asked.
Yeah, but let's face it. I mean, Gustav, I'm not saying that the Knights would have taken Gustav Nyquist, but if you're trying to rid yourself of ugly, laborsome contracts, I mean, Gustav Nyquist makes almost $5 million. Specifically, it's $4.75 million. I don't think he's worth that right now.
Right, but we have to consider what Vegas' goals are in Wednesday's expenditure. And it was pretty clear. They want as many draft picks as they possibly can to stockpile picks and to not get into any bad contracts. You don't want to start a franchise overpaying a guy $5 million who's not worth half of that. So they took guys that made $600,000, $900,000, $1.2 million.
I don't disagree with you at all. I didn't think they were going to take Darren Helm because that's a long-term bad contract. But you could have seen them, and I'm not saying they would have, but you could have seen them taking Gustav Nyquist because he only has 2 years left on that contract. It's not necessarily an albatross for Vegas. It's more of an albatross for Detroit because of all the bad contracts Detroit has associated with it.
Right, so
I still think had they exposed Nyquist and protected Noshek, what they would have done is Vegas would have taken Riley Sheahan.
I think it's a
1 year deal worth $2 million.
I think they got caught in between to a certain extent because we saw there were 8+ teams who worked out trades with Vegas in advance or the night of. Some of those have been announced. Others, the details are still emerging. Most of those are for draft picks, but the Blue Jackets were able to dump David Clarkson's contract onto Vegas. A couple other contracts were moved around. They actually took Riley Smith off of the Panthers' hands to free up a little cap space for Florida.
See?
They got a 30-goal scorer in Jonathan Marchessault. So there are some good players. James Neal, obviously, is a big one who went over there, and there was an interesting...
Marc-Andre Fleury's probably the name or the franchise. Well, I don't know if he's the face of the franchise, but he's the most recognizable.
Until they get a real one, he's absolutely the most identifiable guy with fans. A little bit of a Michigan twist with John Merrill, who is a University of Michigan graduate. Getting picked up from the Devils. He had just been coming on well. Obviously, Noshek. Timu Polkanen, who the Red Wings had to waive at one point last year, picked up by Arizona. Everyone was so angry about that at the time. Well, now he's a selection for the Vegas Golden Knights. Are you really so worried about
it
at this time?
He can't create his own shot. He barely gets open. He's got a one-timer, and that's it.
Right, so the short memory comes into play again. And maybe a year from now, I'll be biting my tongue because Thomas Noshek will have had a great year for Vegas. I wish him nothing but success. This is not bitterness from a Detroit fan who knows that you'll never see him wear the winged wheel again. It's just I'm not so upset about the loss. And, do I wish they could have managed another bad contract away? Yes. But like I said, Detroit was kind of in the in-between here. If they wanted to get rid of a bad deal, they would have had to do what some of these other teams did and trade an excess draft pick. Knowing the situation the Red Wings in and that getting rid of one contract isn't going to change everything for them.
No, but Detroit does have 11 draft picks. You could have lost a fourth-round choice or so and parlay that with a bad contract to Vegas to give yourself a little bit of cap.
Right, so it depends on how bad the contract that you're trying to get rid of it is. And if you're getting rid of Nyquist and it's only 2 years left, maybe you wouldn't have needed to add it a lot on to get Vegas to take that.
Right.
But to look at Columbus, and I know the David Clarkson contract is a bit of an albatross of a contract. That's not a easily navigatable deal.
Right.
They had to give a first-round pick for this year to get them to take
that.
And they still
took
William Nylander from Columbus, who's a productive player. Not amazing, but a productive player. So I don't know what the price was. You saw David Poile had to do this in Nashville. And he said the price was too high to convince them to take someone other than James Neal. It hurts to see him go. That's a guy coming out of the Stanley Cup Final who now goes from two wins or one win away from a shot at a Game 7 for a cup to a franchise who's never played a game before. That
stinks. And he's probably going to finish at the bottom of their division.
I think unquestionably they'll be a bottom two team in the league.
Right. But, I mean, everyone was talking last night as if to say that they've got some unbelievable draft picks and what a way to start. Look, they're building strictly for the future.
That's where
the unbelievable maneuvers were being made.
Now, in fairness, if they wanted to take... We got to go win a cup next year. They could have taken different guys, better guys, and built in a more immediate contender. But
absolutely.
To your point, they would have walked themselves into contract issues. They would have walked themselves into developmental issues for their farm system.
I'm talking about
better to start strong and young.
I'm talking strictly from a Detroit standpoint. I really wish they had held Noshek back. It would have helped Detroit from a financial standpoint. It almost would have forced Vegas to take a bad contract off your hands. Think about it. They're not going to take Cronwall, right? They're not going to take Erickson because of the injuries and age dependent. But they could have taken Mrazek. They could have taken Sheahan. They weren't going to take Luke Glendening because he was hurt. I mean, everything else left for you to force Vegas's hand was, if you're going to take one of our guys, you're going to take that bad contract, and it's going to come off my books. The only player I think that they exposed or was left unprotected was Noshek, who wasn't. It was exactly the opposite for that for the Red Wings, and that's my frustration with that whole thing.
I probably need to readdress the Red Wings protected list. I've kind of forgotten it since I've seen the results of that draft, but I could tell
it to you right now. Tatar, Nyquist.
I guess, right, on the defensive end.
Okay, defensively, so it was Mike Green, it was Danny DeKeyser, and it was Dick Jansen.
Right, so I guess if you protect Noshek, you got to think about who you would have lost. I'm not that hurt by having lost Noshek, and I think if the alternative is them taking Peter Mrazek, I don't know if that's what people want. Right. I would look at who they did take in terms of goaltenders. They took J.F. Berube from the New York Islanders. Their first pick was Calvin Picard from Colorado, and then they took Marc-Andre Fleury. So they took – people had speculation they were going to take six goalies and start wheeling and dealing guys because there's enough clubs out there. Buffalo's going to need some help. Calgary obviously just made a move to go get Mike Smith. Vancouver has Ryan Miller but could need another guy. Carolina could need – there's a lot of teams that are not going to go get a front-of-the-line top-end starter but are going to get either a solid backup or somebody to go in rotation with a guy that they already have in the system. So I think that there's no question that after all the speculation, Vegas, what they ended up doing was just taking three goalies that they want to stay in black, gold, and the little bit of red trim that's on their sweater. They want those guys to be part of their organization, and they see a place for them in the organization moving forward, whereas there's plenty of trades organized for position players, and I think that's where we're going to see the bulk of them come to fruition.
I never thought Vegas would take Peter Mrazek. Never in
a – why? Why does it seem so irrational?
Irrational?
Why not? Okay, Marc-Andre Fleury. When's the last time Marc-Andre Fleury played a full season?
Well, that's a fair point. But that's why they got two other guys. Marc-Andre Fleury. Look, Pittsburgh doesn't win the cup without Marc-Andre Fleury. Peter Mrazek is just a guy. Okay, that's all he is. He's just a guy. He's got a terrible attitude. He's not professional at all.
Right,
and we overvalue our players more than anybody else. Peter Mrazek is just a guy. The three guys they got, I bet you he wasn't even on their radar. I bet you Vegas looked at him and goes, what's the point?
Well, we don't know what George McPhee and
well, I guarantee
their front
you, they know what the Red Wings. They know what the Red Wings know. They know that he was the guy who's the primary reason that Jim Bedard was fired.
We don't know their opinion of the inside of the Red Wings locker room. Maybe they think it's a pressure-packed environment that not a lot of players, or especially European players, will thrive in.
I told you last week the problems with Peter Mrazek. If anybody would listen, I told you last week, and what has come out. Look at all the reports. It's not coincidental. Craig Custance, all these other reports are talking about Peter Mrazek isn't professional. Peter Mrazek has a bad attitude. He left the ice in a morning skate when he found out Jared Coro was going to be the starter. People had to go and chase him down and say, hey, dude, you don't act this way. Who wants to deal with that? He's a 24-year-old baby. People don't want to deal with that.
That's all well and good, but I don't think it's so irrational. What is he making? What, 4.5, right, through arbitration for what, another 1 year or another 2 years?
Right, another year.
Okay,
yeah.
So what is – my question is, what is the big risk for Vegas if you take him as your third goalie, if you still have either Picard or Berube you want as your backup, or even as your backup goalie, knowing that Marc-Andre Fleury is probably not going to play 80 games for you this year.
Right.
You got him on a 1 year. If, you know, 4.5 is too rich for your taste, then he's gone after this year, or you can flip him at the deadline for somebody else that wants to, you know, get a six-round draft pick or something like that back.
But I think easier said than done, saying we'll just flip him at the trade deadline.
If he doesn't play well, then he gets cut. But it's no loss to Vegas. There's no skin off Vegas' teeth. I think he was the most talented goalie, not named Marc-Andre Fleury, that was exposed in that draft.
I would tell you this. Here's what it was to Vegas. It means you miss out on another opportunity to take somebody else who can help you and save you some money.
Right, if they see one of those guys, if they see Picard or Berube as an investment that they're going to build up for a la Jimmy Garoppolo over in New England, a guy that they're going to develop for a couple years and then ship away when they maybe don't need, then that's different. But I see it as a more fragile situation. I don't see Marc-Andre Fleury as an 80-game player. I see one of the two goalies that they drafted needing to be able to play for them and put them in competitive situations. Yeah. And I'm not saying that the two guys they took couldn't do that, but I think Peter Mrazek was a lot safer and more sure bet to do that. And I think he's the guy that you can hit a home run on.
I think you're underestimating the negativity that is associated with the individual. And that is, when you go into a locker room, the last thing you want to have to deal with, especially when you're Gerard Gallant taking over a new program, is this guy being a difficult player.
Then why'd they take James Neal?
Is James Neal have the same reputation as Peter Mrazek, where he's actually given up on teammates and things like that?
He's kind of swept out of a locker room or two before he got to Nashville. I know he wore a letter in Nashville, but I don't know. I know they're not all one-for-one situations, yeah. And I'm not trying to make excuses for Peter Mrazek's attitude, because it sounds like it was a major inhibitor on him for either being a contributing member to the Red Wings in the latter half of the season or having a legit chance at a fresh start during the expansion draft. I just don't think it's – again, I'm not pounding the table for that, but I just don't think it's as irrational as we've made it out to be for Vegas to have taken them, whereas everyone else made it seem like an easy choice.
All right, well, as I've made it out to be, not we. Last thing before we end this episode of Shep Shower and Jave, brought to you by Fifth Avenue and Northwestern Tech. The NBA draft, by the time this is thrown out there, the NBA draft will have concluded, but – the NBA draft is tonight. I just want the one guy you think the Pistons will take, and I'll give you three names since they're the closest associated with Detroit. Ready? The names are Donovan Mitchell, Louisville guard. I think he's in the form of a Joe Dumars-type player. Luke Kennard, the shooting guard from Duke, who is a terrible perimeter defender but can shoot the blood out of it at 6'6". Or Zach Collins, who's a stretch four out of Gonzaga. Who do you think the Pistons go with tonight?
I think what I've seen be projected as kind of the safest pick or the most likely pick is probably Kennard, and that's, I think, by virtue of the fact that most people expect he will still be there at 12.
Right.
But I think the most excitement probably comes about Donovan Mitchell. What do you think?
If Donovan Mitchell's there, I would take him. I think he'll be gone, thus I think they'll take Luke Kennard because of the shooting aspect. If they take Zach Collins, and look, he's a good player, don't get me wrong, he's 19. That's another stretch four. They already have Tobias Harris, John Luehr, Henry Ellenson, and then you're going to take Zach Collins. Unless there's a trade in the making, that would gravely disappoint me if I'm a Pistons fan, which I am.
A trade up or trade down?
Well,
or maybe one that doesn't involve that draft slot.
I suppose it depends. I think it depends on who I'm talking about, players that they may trade.
Okay.
There is a belief that Andre Drummond is on the block like there was last year, which nothing more would excite me than that opportunity.
Interesting you say that, because I was going to ask if another guy, I don't know if the perception is he would have to slip to get to 12 or that 12 might be the right spot for him, but Lauri Markkanen's also a guy whose name's been associated with Detroit a little bit. Not as strong a fit or as strong an NBA projection as the first three names you mentioned, and I think Pistons fans, though they have a number of needs, would really like to see somebody that can shoot the ball besides Kentavious Caldwell-Pope.
Well, he's also a legit 7-footer.
Right,
okay.
But so my point is, if Drummond's on the block and part of that part of that move, the construct of that move is replacing him in the middle, is Lauri Markkanen a guy the Pistons will look at?
I don't know. Another stretch four. I think somehow they have to do a better job of getting guys on the perimeter who can create shots and make shots. I don't think they have nearly enough of those. Shep Shower and Shave brought to you by Northwestern Tech and by Fifth Avenue in Royal Oak.